Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Is Tech News Today for Friday, June 3rd, 2011. Tech News Today is brought to you by FreshBooks, the easy online invoicing service that gets you paid quickly and makes you look professional. Get started with a free package today at FreshBooks.com. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zachter.
And I'm Jason Howell.
Tom Merritt is off today. He's getting a wisdom tooth removed.
Just a single tooth?
Yeah, just the one.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't know why. He said he was a late bloomer. They came in late.
Now he's being gassed and they're removing it.
Yeah, they're putting him under. I mean, it's kind of a big deal.
He's afraid he's going to wake up with an accent, is what he was saying on Twitter.
Yeah, he's really taking this hard. Hopefully he'll be fine. He'll be back Monday. Luckily, we are joined by none other than Scott Johnson, Mr. Frog Pants himself. And of course, you know him, you love him from Forecast on the Twit Network.
How's it going, everybody? Thank you for having me on today. I really appreciate it. I heard Tom told me that he was going to ask to keep the tooth. So we'll see if he gets to actually walk away with that thing and name it and keep it and do whatever he's going to do with it.
Yeah, you know, and I don't think he was kidding about that either. He said he wanted to wear the tooth and a necklace around his neck.
I thought he was
going to
redesign the whole TNT set around the tooth.
Yeah.
He's really obsessed with this thing.
Yeah. It'll be a memento. So, wow. Tom, yeah, we miss you, especially on Liquid Friday, but hopefully he's doped up enough.
He's having his own
he's
type
having a different
of liquid
kind.
Today.
Liquid morphine, for example. All right, so, you know, for Friday, we have a somewhat heavy show.
Yeah.
Some kind of big story, starting with internet service being not completely shut down in Syria, but widely shut down. There have been, obviously, if you've been watching the news, quite a few protests as of late in Syria. Renesis is reporting that starting at 3:35 UTC, which was 6:35 a.m. local time in Syria, approximately two-thirds of all the networks in Syria became unreachable. Now, apparently, Syrian internet access is primarily controlled by Syriatel. That's state-owned. And what's interesting is that a third of that network that's online belongs to the government. And some of that is still up. Oil Ministry is up. Syrian Telecom's official page is up. But Ministry of Education, Damascus City Government page, and the Syrian Customs website all down. And we still don't really know what happened here.
Yeah, I mean, there's been protests for months that the Syrian citizens have been trying to call for the ouster of the president there. And this is kind of similar to what happened in Egypt when protests got so far.
Mm-hmm.
Egypt shut down, the government shut down the internet there, so the communications became much more difficult. So that's what this looks like, but there's no official, actual explanation right now.
So there really is there no way to tell if this is that, the government doing it, or this is an infrastructure being destroyed, torn out, temporarily disabled by the people themselves? We don't have any way of knowing if sort of rioting or anything got so far as to sort of destroy, you know, key components of how their internet works in Syria?
It does sound like their internet access is a complicated infrastructure anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they get internet via
a pipeline that's underwater.
There's some stuff coming in from Cyprus. What's
telling on this is that a third of the network that's still up, that is the government has access to it right now. So that it's basically the public's internet that they can't use. The government can access the internet. And that seems like it looks suspicious. It looks like the government.
It looks suspicious, especially since Google, as of today, has said via Twitter, Google services are currently blocked in Syria. Syria has also blocked networks that can help people kind of band together and organize things like protests in city squares via Facebook. I mean, Facebook has been banned in Syria, I think, the last 4 years. So there are many indicators that point to this being having to do with opponents gathered at a hotel. This actually happened on Wednesday. About 300 opponents of the president wanted to band together and kind of give voice to a movement that...
Right now, there's no real leader of this movement, the protest. So when these 300 joined at this hotel, they're trying to come up with some kind of structure, some kind of way to actually formally announce their passion that they dislike this president.
These kinds of stories, they're hard to report on because information is just still coming in. I mean, we don't really know on our end what's going on. And that's the scary thing about countries that lose a large portion of internet access almost immediately, is that we're all trying to piece together what could be going on. Why are some government sites up and others not? And people are having a hard time communicating to the outside world what's happening.
I always find it kind of interesting, too, what the larger internet-based companies start to do to try to do their, their commitment to sort of freedom and open expression. You'll see Google try to do some things and Facebook try to do some things and even Twitter. And I guess, I mean, other than Google confirming today that Google services are currently completely blocked in Syria, we haven't heard if they've got workarounds, if there's any kind of crazy proxy server stuff going on, or if they found any way to get in. I mean, if there's only one big pipe in and not any kind of redundancy like that, it seems like we, or I should say they would have a hard time doing those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hopefully the story will unfold over the weekend and we'll have a little bit more of a concrete idea of what is going on by Monday's show. On U.S. soil, sort of, the White House says government email not compromised via Gmail hacks because government email doesn't go through Gmail.
That's right. There was this hack that Google was reporting about that a bunch of their accounts that
government officials were
subject of phishing scams. Mm-hmm. And so the FBI and Department of Homeland Security is working with Google to try to find out exactly what's going on. But in a White House press briefing, they were explaining that no U.S. government accounts were compromised in this case. But the problem is they didn't say whether sensitive information was already accessed in these personal accounts, because the official rule in the White House is you cannot discuss business matters on your personal email.
But you can have a personal email.
Exactly.
And that would frequently be something like a Gmail address.
And there's a reason why this is kind of fishy, because if you write something in your government email, in your White House email, it's subject to the Freedom of Information Act. So people can call that up and they can use it against you if you're getting in any kind of trouble. So people might try to work around that by using their personal email. So who knows what's in their personal email that could have been compromised.
Scott, what do you think? I mean, are government workers any different than the rest of us when you might want to use a personal email account to communicate information that you wouldn't want your boss to be reading over your shoulder?
Well, I am no major conspiracist by any means, but there's a tiny little dude inside me that likes to talk about conspiracies. And one would be if I worked for a government, office or something, that it didn't matter what my personal email account was, they would probably monitor it, especially in sensitive areas. So if you're working in the CIA or something else and you have a personal email account, I'm guessing that it's just part of the deal that they're going to know what you're sending in and out, because they'll tell you that you can't share secrets or talk about work, but they need to make sure you don't. So my guess is those guys are getting watched anyway.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether you feel like you have a personal one or not. I'm guessing it's not that personal.
For what it's worth, the Chinese Foreign Affairs Minister Hong Lei told reporters that allegations that the Chinese government supports hacking activities are completely unfounded and made with ulterior motives, which sounds like what China usually says when they're accused of things. Not saying that, that they did or they didn't, but that's what they're saying anyway. The U.S. still says we're not going to even discuss this with China until we actually know what's going on.
Right,
they don't
now
have all their facts
unclear
yet.
Isn't
exactly.
It wasn't this same attack happened to Yahoo and Hotmail? It wasn't even exclusively a Gmail hack anyway.
Yeah.
So this is going around.
Yeah, exactly. Google is one of many in the phishing scam wars or without China.
Yeah, the human element still is the trouble right there.
Exactly.
If you fall for the scam.
Humans can be tricked.
Yeah, so no matter how good Google or Yahoo or Hotmail gets, you never know.
All right. Amazon may soon need to collect sales tax. At least that's what Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin, he's a Democrat from Illinois, says. He wants to introduce a bill called the Main Street Fairness Act.
Don't you love these names? They always sound so positive.
Well,
like the Patriot Act,
he's on the side of mom and pop. Mm-hmm. At least that's the idea. The idea is to mandate that all businesses, whether you're online or you're on Main Street, collect sales tax in the state where the consumer resides. So if I live in California and I buy something off Amazon, doesn't really matter where the goods are coming from, I need to pay sales tax, because that's what I would pay if I went down to my local corner store
exactly
and bought the same item.
Amazon's
aren't the
Go ahead.
Aren't the laws right now set up that if Amazon had a store, like if they had a store in Salt Lake City and they were then selling to me over, you know, online, I'd have to pay taxes, because the law currently as it stands is that if there is a place of sort of retail business or whatever within the state that the item's purchased from, even if they get it online, like Walmart.com or Apple.com, where I do pay tax, then that's the rule. And if you don't have a store like that, then you don't.
That is the rule. It's just that Amazon doesn't have any retail stores. So they've been able to get around this where something like Walmart can't.
Yeah, there's been an argument as to whether these places, these distribution centers that they have, does that constitute that nexus, this thing that allows the state to collect taxes from these guys. But a federal law would get around this entire thing. The Main Street Fairness Act would say, look, you know, there's all these rulings at the Supreme Court saying you can't do this, but a federal law will totally supersede that. So this could mean that Amazon would say, okay, fine, we'll charge you taxes. We don't really care. But as long as there's one rule, Jeff Bezos himself has said, it's pretty much a mess right now. Like, there's like 30,000 different laws between state and local sales tax laws. They don't know who to collect from and where you are and all this other stuff. At least if there's some kind of federal regulation, one standard for all, it'd be very easy to implement a taxation system based on that.
This has also become a big issue because states don't have any money right now. I mean, a lot of states are in a lot of trouble. Collecting sales tax would help them out. And Amazon has proved itself to be a very successful business. Back in the early days of Amazon, people were more willing to say, they've got different rules. They're introducing a new commerce strategy. Let's sort of see how it goes. Well, it's obviously very successful, and states have missed out on quite a bit of uncollected online sales tax. A University of Tennessee study estimated that states lost over $10 billion in uncollected sales tax just this year, projecting even more, over $11 billion next year. And
won't this mess with everybody, though? Like, it doesn't matter. I mean, Amazon's a huge target, and they're a big example in this, but this trickles all the way down to guys like me who sell their own artwork and T-shirts over their website and don't currently have to charge tax because they're selling to out-of-state buyers or whatever. That this would trickle down to all of us, I would assume.
Yeah, it's going to affect everybody pretty much the same, unless the law is like kind of specific. Like, let's say they're saying you have to have employees, more than 50 employees or something like that. But that specific information is not there yet.
Yeah, Amazon obviously has a lot of control too. A good example of this is in Texas. There was legislature that would have forced online retailers with distribution facilities in the state of Texas to collect sales tax. Amazon said, okay, you want to do that? Well, we're going to close our shipping center that was outside of Dallas. We'll fire many hundreds of local workers, and we're not going to build any other facilities in the state because it's not a good state for us to invest in. And then the governor, Rick Perry, said, okay, I'll just go ahead and veto that bill because, of course, they don't want to contribute to the unemployment rate either. So Amazon's got... They've got power here.
Yeah, they've stopped this kind of stuff before. This one in Texas wasn't the only one. They've threatened to close down distribution plants in lots of different areas, and usually the law just completely collapses because there's no way they're going to cause all this trouble in one town. I mean, that's like hundreds of jobs lost because of this one law. But then again, a federal thing, there's no way Amazon's going to get around that.
And Scott, you make a good point too. If you're an independent artist, maybe you've got a somewhat successful Etsy store. There's so many examples of independent folks who, if they were under the same law, could really be a dent in the money that they pull in.
Well, plus people like Etsy and other third party sites that sort of do the distribution arm for some smaller businesses or some individuals would probably be held to some standards of enforcing that and making sure that happened at their level. So, if you know, it just seems like this would tax people in more than just money. It'd be less. It wouldn't be just monetary taxing. It would tax people's time. It would tax resources. It would make costs go up. It just seems like it's so simple now. It's just such a clean, simple system that those who have retail locations have to abide by their half of the law, and those who don't live by their half. And it's clean and easy. So not really for this change, personally.
I would think with the payment systems like PayPal or something like that, they probably would build this in as a tool right away if this was the situation. So even if it did affect this, like a small businessman or something like that, I'm thinking that the private sector is going to figure this out right away because they still want to make their money. They still want to make sure that things are still running. So I would imagine it wouldn't be that difficult to implement, actually.
It's also, I mean, to look at the other side of it, I mean, this is called the Main Street Fairness Act for a reason. Imagine if every store that was on the main streets in towns all across America had to pay sales tax, and the Amazons didn't. I mean, who would ever go to the stores?
Well,
it just, I mean, you kind of kill that business model,
you're
too.
You're saying that all the prices are equal? Or like the mainstream
I'm
price?
Saying that most people, if they have to buy toilet paper and it's either $2 or $1, they will buy it for $1. Because people, I mean, why would you pay more money?
I have no argument against that. I really don't.
Nothing else to say to add to that.
When it comes to toilet paper, I'm not going to argue.
We all need it, and you want to pay as little as possible. And especially with the convenience of Amazon delivering to your door, it's like it's hard. It's hard for smaller businesses, especially at this time. All right, well, there's obviously more to come on that story. Whether Amazon pulls through or not, we will know soon enough. Let's take a moment to thank FreshBooks for sponsoring this episode of TNT. I almost said iPad Today, but that's not what show this is.
This is TNT.
This is TNT, and it's Liquid Friday. Everything's going to be okay, Sarah.
You still say the today part of that?
Yes.
TN Today.
This show today.
Yeah.
Sponsored by FreshBooks. Yeah, if you're an independent contractor, Scott Johnson knows all about this. Sometimes you have to invoice people. You know, you've got an agreement with a client. You do some work for them, and they're supposed to pay you. And invoicing is part of getting yourself paid. And invoicing can be a huge hassle. And that's where FreshBooks comes in, because it is the easiest way to keep your invoices all in one place, make you look professional, and get paid quickly and timely. Not only will FreshBooks manage your client base, but they'll help clients with reminders. You can set up reminders if a client's supposed to pay you on the 10th and you need to be paid on the 10th. You can make sure that that happens. There are a variety of ways that you can get paid via FreshBooks from your clients. PayPal, for example, just direct deposit. You can even go through the old-fashioned mail if that's the way that you or your clients want to work. Not a problem. iPhone apps, if you're a person that's on the go and you just kind of, you really need to be managing your money, there's a good mobile ways to keep track of what you've been doing, how many hours you've put in. If you're an hourly worker, and a lot of folks are, that stuff matters. FreshBooks will just kind of manage all of that. And what's awesome is that maybe you're just getting into the contract game, or you just have 3 clients or less, the whole thing's free. You can use FreshBooks, 3 clients or less, for no money at all. And if you have more clients, then their rates are very, very reasonable. FreshBooks.com is where you go, and when you sign up with them, and you can just check it out. See if it works for you. Start with 3 clients, and then, if you're successful and you have 15 clients, they are the best way to manage your invoices. You got to get paid. That's what it's about. Get paid.
Can you still get cake?
Oh, yes, the cake. I almost forgot. This is the best. Okay, FreshBooks, if I didn't already convince you that they're an awesome service, they have a weekly drawing. So if you go to FreshBooks and you go ahead and sign up for an account, you will automatically be entered in a weekly drawing to win a birthday cake. Doesn't have to be your birthday. FreshBooks doesn't even really care what your birthday is. They're just like, hey, you want a cake? Maybe you'll win. We actually got a cake here one day on TNT, and we ate it, and it was delicious.
Again, if you don't win the cake, since you invoiced, you can go ahead and go buy yourself a cake.
That's right.
That's the best thing.
That's
about
absolutely
this.
Right.
So either win a cake or buy a cake, you can do it with FreshBooks.
So we thank FreshBooks.com, and be sure to let them know that you came through TNT so they know that we're awesome. Thanks, FreshBooks. You're the best. All right, moving on now to the UN. Disconnecting file sharers breaches human rights. That's a report anyway, written by Frank LaRue. And this one really rolls off the tongue. The name of the report is called The Report of the Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of the Right to Freedom of Opinion and Expression. And it's set to be adopted today by the UN's Human Rights Council, which is why this is significant. And in short, it pretty much says disconnecting internet users for violating the rights of music and movie industries actually breaches human rights.
Yeah, but I mean, this is just a report, and this is the UN adopting it, which means that its member nations need to do nothing. They don't have to do a dang thing about it. So while we can all argue and say, hey, look, if you cut off our internet access, even the UN is on our side. I mean, if you're in a place like France and they have a three strikes law, well, it doesn't mean they're going to follow the UN's recommendations. So it's nice to see that. I guess when you get everybody together in the room and they agree on this idea that it's a human right, it doesn't mean it's going to have an effect in your country.
I mean, yeah, this all kind of came about because of the UK's Digital Economy Act, for example, France's Hadopi, which is also the 3 strikes law, which are obviously very controversial. And in many cases, people think they can be wrongly accused of many, many sorts of things, which is a human rights violation in the eyes of many. But what does it mean? Well, nothing. Governments aren't required to do anything. I mean, they're getting a little bit of pressure. There's a open rights group, ORG, or org.
It's like a stern look from the UN saying,
Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty much the entire
effect. Is this really what you want to do, this three-strikes
law? Yeah, I'm not afraid of
that. The open rights group, they're trying to put the pressure on the UK Cultural Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, but they just kind of want his reaction. Hey, what's your reaction to this report? We think that you should recommend that the Digital Economy Act's disconnection provisions should be repealed, but they don't actually have the power to force any government to do anything. So what does this mean?
It means that the UN's on our side, but still has no teeth. That's unfortunately the reality. It's a more political, partially political story still, that being a part of the UN doesn't mean that we have to listen to what they say.
Scott, what do you think? I mean, if reports like this will not be silenced, will governments be forced to at least acknowledge their existence?
Well, I think that the reason they do this is if they are loud enough about any one issue and they sort of pound it into the international community enough times, that eventually that has some sort of sway. And the reason that may have sway is people in those nations themselves may react to it and say, well, we're a group that's organized to fight this, and look, the UN supports us, so now we have this extra thing to say that makes sort of a big deal, either locally or nationally or whatever. So it seems like they are toothless. I picture this old man gumming at the world, trying to get him to do things. He can't do anything because there's no teeth. But in the end, no teeth or no teeth, and of course they're not going to have teeth with this, and we're not going to do something they tell us to do either. Because, you know, if it's something that doesn't fit our quote-unquote national interest, then why would we? And that's how everybody else does it. So this is all they can do, is just say, hey, we think this, and really smart people wrote this, and this other guy said this, and it's their way of making or affecting change. But you're right, it's a toothless change, and it only makes change if somebody can then take this, add it to an already powerful arsenal of information or an already strong cause, and then take it forward, and that's all they can do.
Or we could take a totally different approach. We could say, you know what? Sarkozy is going to change his mind completely based on this. You know, because he's not outspoken about this at all, you know.
Yeah, the movie and music industries, screw them.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen.
The citizens are the ones who should be making these decisions.
Imagine that. Yeah.
That's
a bold prediction.
Money is not a factor at all.
Yeah, and by toothless, I wasn't trying to make fun of Tom Merritt in his current state of missing a tooth.
I think he still has a few teeth.
He's got a few teeth left, but he's toothless.
Right. He is toothless. Very good point. All right. Motorola is blaming crappy apps. Motorola says crappy apps are to blame for poor performance, and something called MotoBlur will save the day.
That's right. Basically, Sanjay Jha, the Motorola Mobility CEO, started talking, decided to say, tell you what, the reason why Android devices are returned, 70% of them are returned because of poor performance. And that's caused by all these apps, because Android's open and these apps are just ripping up. They're just tearing apart performance. They're killing batteries. They're doing terrible things to processors. But MotoBlur, we can actually go ahead and collect data on using MotoBlur. MotoBlur is a little skin that Moto puts on their phones, Android phones.
Many people complain.
Right.
Degrades the quality of their experience.
It's a little intrusive. It's a very large skin on Android. I mean, if you just rip off the actual UI, you might feel like, hey, this is a lot lighter. But the idea is that MotoBlur would be able to catalog what happens with these applications, and it would give you a warning if you were going to download an application that is known to be a battery hog or a processor destroyer.
Exactly.
Yeah. This is like trying to ask, you know, Windows users to go back to using Bob as their main interface. I hate this idea. Like, you give me the raw OS, or don't give me anything, or give me Apple's, you know, walled garden OS. At least I know what I'm getting there. It's like this idea of some weird middleware to sort of, I guess maybe it works for grandma. That just would not work for me at all.
Don't you think the reason MotoBlur exists at all is because back then, when Android first came out, it was kind of ugly. It wasn't exactly as polished as it is now. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, you still need to differentiate your product, because if HTC has Android and Samsung has Android, what makes your phone different at that point? You need to have some kind of hook. That doesn't mean this is any better. I'm just saying that this is...
I just love how Motorola is like, listen, you're going to have to go through Blur, and it's going to slow everything down a little bit, but we're going to tell you which apps are bad.
Well, I don't think they said it'd slow you down.
No, that's sort of what many folks are accusing them of. But then you sort of say, okay, so the eventual idea is Blur collects info on bad experiences, apps or otherwise, all that stuff goes into a database, and then users would be warned when they decide to install or run some sort of an app that has a bad reputation. Blur would say, you really want to do that? Because here's how many people had a bad experience. Doesn't that just kind of sound like an app store rating system?
Well, and there's two groups of people. There are people who will see that warning and go, oh, I hate this freaking warning. I just want to skip it, and I know what I want.
Exactly. That's right. Shut up, Blur. You're not the boss of me.
The other group is my mom, who will be terrified of every warning and not download a thing and never have an app.
But she'll have great performance. You see? Exactly. Well, there you go.
She'll have great performance, but she'll be afraid to do anything.
She'll make phone calls. Yep.
Somebody didn't like that.
Kind of feels a little weaselly to me for Motorola to kind of be going to this degree where it's almost like that person like pointing out at every turn, see how good we are because we didn't do that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It just seems really annoying.
What if people have like bad experiences with Moto Blur? Will Blur tell you that?
Right. Warning. Your experience may suck thanks to us.
You bought the wrong phone, buddy. I also want to know where Sanjay Jha gets his 70% of Android devices are returned because of a bad app experience. I mean, that's probably true, but I just like to know.
I think it's 70% of those returned are because of a bad app experience is what he's kind of pointing to, but
I mean, the number sounds high.
His use of the terminology seems wrong. 70% returned phones is very different than 70% of the returned phones, yeah.
Exactly. But I would be the first to admit that there are a lot of apps out there that are not very good at managing your memory or managing your battery. Mm-hmm. You know, they haven't been coded in the proper way. There's some truth to what he's saying here that apps in general, you know, can wreak havoc on your phone, but that's not, you know, he's taking Motorola entirely out of the equation, and that's wrong.
Joshua Caleb in the chat room says it best. He says, crapware will not save us from crapware. And I agree with that.
Very true, Joshua Caleb. True words have never been spoken. Okay, some news already leaking out. E3 isn't until next week, but we're already hearing about Xbox Live Diamond. That's a subscription TV service, which would basically be Xbox Live, but with IPTV enabling. But as you actually were explaining to me before the show, this is more like just a cable subscription service.
Effectively, yeah, because Microsoft would be negotiating deals with television networks, and you'd be able to watch television, streaming television, on your Xbox. So effectively, you wouldn't be getting your television through your cable system. You could just have an internet-only kind of connection, right? Let's say through Comcast. Mm-hmm. And then you just connect it. You connect your Xbox via Ethernet or Wi-Fi or whatever, but you sign up with Microsoft, and you'll be able to watch television, which is actually a pretty interesting idea because, I mean, Xbox has sold like a ton. Microsoft was trumpeting the number 55 million Xbox 360 sold worldwide, which is like apparently the best-selling console ever or something.
That's a big number.
I mean, using that console for a set-top box effectively is kind of interesting because Microsoft also upgrades their UI often. I've had set-top boxes from certain companies whose name I won't use. Those things really, the firmware is usually pretty awful, and you have to call in a service person to get anything done. Xbox 360, you can just kind of upgrade whenever you want. Pretty easy. So I'm kind of intrigued with this.
Yeah, I love
I'm
the idea.
I'm stoked for it.
You're beyond stoked?
Wait. Yeah, well, here's the deal. I've gone full IPTV. Everything in my house is Roku boxes, and there's an Apple TV on one TV, and there's something else upstairs, and I got a little media PC somewhere else, and that's all what I do. So it's all Hulu and Boxy and just all that kind of stuff, Netflix streaming. This is really interesting to me, and it's interesting, I think, that 55 million Xboxes, by the way, that's not the record, but it's dang close. I think the PS2 currently holds the current record for somewhere in the 80 million. So they're on their way to do that. This is a well-entrenched console in this market, and a whole lot of people would subscribe to this, me included. I am so ready for the service, I can barely stand it. And as long as my Xbox doesn't sound like a jet taking off when I'm running it, I'll be really happy with this. I think this will be something that I think, not just gamers, but there are a lot of people out there who've got this thing in their living room. Their kids use it for games, but they don't really touch it. And this is a nice extension to some of those people to say, hey, here's your media set-top box. You know, we've been promised for decades, and, you know, finally it's here and you already own it.
Yeah, Microsoft claims 40% of all Xbox activity isn't even for gaming. It's for other stuff, consuming media in a variety of ways. I have Comcast in my house. I'm not real crazy about their UI, but that's my only option. I literally have no other option unless I want to cut the cord entirely. So just to have another option from Microsoft that then I could put them side by side and say which is the better deal for me is awesome.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I'm thinking about that real life situation where you're like, do I have any other provider available other than Dish?
I have no other
satellite
provider that
it's
I
like no. Or you're in an apartment, you can't do that because of the building restrictions. This actually gives you options. I didn't even think about that. But when I used to live in the city, that was always an issue. It was always Time Warner or nothing.
Exactly.
So,
which is why I still have cable.
Some correction here. Someone in the chat reminds me the PS2 sales were over 150 million install base, and they still release games on that thing. It's the weirdest success in the history
Might
of the
be
world.
The fastest selling or something. I'm sure that Microsoft has the right wording there.
They'll spin it.
Well, they didn't say they were top. They just said 55 million. That's a lot.
It claims its console history. What kind of history? I have no idea yet. That's what they say. No other console in history can make that claim, which was
with the
what?
Name Xbox in front of it, right?
So I'm sure there's some kind of nice, statistics are really good for making up what you want.
Well, we'll definitely be following all of the debut of the Diamond service from Xbox. Hopefully, we'll get a little bit of a walkthrough. We'll be covering E3 at great length here on Twit, so we'll know more very soon. Also, some interesting information coming out. This is also related to E3 from OnLive. OnLive is actually, if you're not familiar with them, they're a games on demand service, which debuted about a year ago. And the whole idea is that users can play kind of high quality, high end games without needing a high end computer because games are stored on OnLive's data centers. And they don't say how many users they have, but they have about 100 titles. And recently, they announced that they would release Red Faction Armageddon on Live the same day that it launches in stores. So you have to assume that publishers are enthusiastic to work with on Live, or else they wouldn't give them those kinds of deals. Anyway, they say, we're going to start working with Facebook, among others. But with the Facebook launch, the idea is that you could play a game and then share your favorite scene. And they're calling this a brag clip. Like, look at this crazy scene where I did so well. Instantly on Facebook with your friends from within Facebook. So this is kind of like the whole idea of the Netflix integration and the music integration within Facebook. Now this is the gaming integration within Facebook, where you don't actually have to leave the Facebook experience to be able to socialize experiences like high-end gaming.
So instead of seeing those stupid invites for Farmville or Mafia, whatever it is, I'll see invites for better games, I guess.
Well, this is also a bit of a spin because, I mean, games have been doing this for about 5 years now where they've integrated directly with something like, say, YouTube. So I just picked up Dirt 3, for example, and Dirt 3 has YouTube integration to the point that if I just had a wild crash in some car in the middle of some African desert, I can upload a clip, like 15-second clip of that immediately to my YouTube account. So this kind of stuff is not super new. The interesting spin here is their technology is pretty cool, what OnLive does. It's pretty cool in the sense that I can play a game in real time with the right kind of internet connection and have it look really good and be very responsive and all those things. That alone is really amazing. But they figured out a way with the same compression to send video left and right, up and down to all kinds of different places, all kind of in real time without really dinging performance. And it's pretty impressive stuff. So it's nice to see them, expanding. I read something today about their iPad integration. They're going to do a standalone controller to use with an iPad or any other tablet, and the screen would act as the screen, and you could play your OnLive games there. That's all very interesting to gamers.
Yeah, OnLive wants to be everywhere. In addition to that, Scott, they say, OnLive says, our service will work with Intel-based consumer TVs, whatever those are. We were trying to figure out what specifically do they mean by that.
If you go to Intel's smart TV section and you try to buy one of the devices, the only link sends you to Best Buy to buy a Google TV.
All right.
So that's Intel powered. I'm sure more TVs are coming soon.
Blu-ray players, they say, also set-top boxes, TV sets made by Vizio. Online. I mean, the idea is that with Facebook and all, they want to be ubiquitous.
This is the Netflix approach.
Exactly.
Be everywhere, and people will use the service no matter what.
Be everywhere, and you will have, they say they'll be accessible by 25 million TV sets by the end of the year. So TV sets alone.
So TV sets will effectively be consoles, video game consoles right there.
Well, the whole idea is that everyone's, routing stuff through the TV now.
That's awesome.
Wonder if they'll be on Xbox Live Diamond.
That would be odd if you had cloud gaming, so the Xbox 360 just... I don't see why not.
Seems unlikely,
A little bit of a loop.
Certainly capable of playing it, but I can't see Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo. None of those guys like this.
UN will actually have a fact. Sure, Xbox will let it in PS3.
Why not? They got to be everywhere, right? OnLive is also launching in the UK in the fall, so expect the user base to grow, whatever it is. They don't want to tell us that yet. And again, we'll get more details about more of their announcements. Facebook was just one of the seven or so announcements that they're very excited to tell us more about at E3 next week. So you'll have to stay tuned for that. But for now, let's move on to the news views. Looks like Lulzsec was telling the truth about hacking Sony Pictures. The Associated Press made some phone calls using the data posted on the Hacker Group site and found the breach to be the real deal. Sony's still investigating the claims, but hasn't made an official statement about this breach. Yeah, although they're probably crying into their sandwich somewhere.
The AP report's kind of funny. It's like this like old lady was on
the
phone.
We made a phone call.
In her 80s. She's like, oh, that's okay. I don't mind.
The phone told us the breach was real.
If you've been wondering what that old school hacking group Anonymous has been up to, well, we got an update here. Turns out they decided to swipe some data from Iran. Anonymous announced it stole over 10,000 emails from the Iranian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and even put them up for download via BitTorrent. How nice of them. Mm-hmm. The emails all relate to visa requests made by non-Iranians.
According to a report in Business Week, Sprint is close to a deal with Light Squared, which would bring the LTE to Sprint. Light Squared would pay Sprint $20 billion over 15 years. Man, that's a lot of money. What's in it for Light Squared? It would have access to the network that Sprint constructs and could sell 4G services to other parties.
AT&T Mobility CEO Ralph De La Vega apparently likes to make his PR people panic. Talking about when AT&T will meet Verizon's 4G quality, De La Vega said, in the next 2 to 3 years, they'll probably be indistinguishable. 2 to 3 years. Maybe he didn't realize that, you know, he was speaking in public when he was sitting on stage at the All Things D conference. Well, I mean, also streaming live to anyone who wanted to tune in.
That's like Ballmer-esque.
Very.
2 to 3 years. We'll be good. It'll be okay.
I didn't mean that.
HTC's Android skin, known as SenseUI, is going open source this summer. The company announced plans to release the OpenSense SDK along with tutorials in a few weeks. Who knows? Maybe people will use this as an opportunity to port SenseUI to non-HTC phones.
Like that Motorola thing and get rid of Blur.
Makes sense.
Based on valuation estimates, Nokia is like an old car, worth more in pieces than as a whole. If Nokia separated its infrastructure equipment, mapping software, and mobile phone business, Nokia could be worth $39 billion. There's another big number. Nokia's current market value is $25.6 billion. Now cue the sad trombone. Jason.
Thank you for the cue.
Poor Nokia. 3 years ago, comparing Nokia to an old car would just have seemed silly.
Just scrap them.
Yeah, things change quickly. Intel's been thumping its chest, saying, oh, actually, that's not what it was saying at all. It was saying, our processors will be in tablets and mobile devices. Dagnabbit. Tweakers.net ran some benchmarks on NVIDIA Tegra 2-based Android tablets and Atom-based prototype tablets also running Android. The Tegra 2 tablets pretty much destroyed the Atom 1 when looking at caffeine marks. However, the Atom tablet did well on the JavaScript browser rendering test, so it's still in the early days, but don't count out Intel just yet.
It still was a prototype and it's still a chest beating to go. So, how did Apple manage to get all four record labels to join in its iCloud service? Simple. Apple threw a huge wad of cash at them. The New York Post reports that Apple is paying the labels between $100 and $150 million in an advance. That amount is the total amount paid. Each of the labels will get around $25 to $50 billion. Million dollars, depending on how many tracks consumers are storing.
Oh, what's the difference between million and billion
to the record
these
industry,
days?
There is none.
No.
Right? To them, it should be billion, but it's millions.
Oh, did we say million? A billion?
It must have been typo.
We can
billion,
afford
million.
It.
Million. It's all one fine. Letter. Yeah.
All right, on to today's randomizer.
Randomizer.
Turns out our dictionary has some really exciting new words, stuff that's in the vernacular for many of us, such as NSFW. Ayaz, do you know what NSFW means?
Not safe for work.
Besides a show on the Twit Network?
Not safe for work.
That's right.
NSFW is now legitimized in the dictionary.
Yeah, it's a real word.
Mm-hmm.
As well as ZOMG, also known as ZOMAGAD, or ZOMG, if you just like the acronym
like spelling things.
Which is, oh my God, with a Z for no reason.
When you're so excited to type it, that's what happens. You ended up.
Why is that one in there? That's a dumb one.
Oh, there's a whole lot of dumb ones in here, actually.
I agree with you, Scott. Isn't oh my God and any variation of oh my God just still oh my God?
Yeah, it is. Plus, NSFW has some actual, I don't know, it has more meaning. It has more stuff behind it.
Yeah. Right.
And I mean, what is the Z?
ZOMG.
What does the Z really mean?
Maybe it's talking about Zeus. You ever think about that? Well, it's about Zeus. He was a god.
You could say, what's LOL? I mean, it should just be, you're just still laughing.
But there's a lot more. There's like breadcrumb trail, Cyber Monday, that stupid made-up holiday where everybody sells things.
Oh, man. Yeah,
infographic, life hack, Naked, N-E-K-K-I-D, also made it.
That one I actually like. I like Naked.
Well, I had to go in with NSFW, right?
That's just redneck naked, right?
Naked. I'm naked.
And permalink. How is permalink not in the dictionary?
That's an interesting one. Permalink is a real thing. I use permalinks. Well, I click on them very often. I don't know whether I use them really otherwise, unless I'm writing a blog post. Twitter sphere is also in the dictionary, which annoys me because...
It's a variant of blogosphere.
Well, and it just sounds like hemisphere. It's Twitterverse is more of like the universe within Twitter. I prefer Twitterverse to Twitter sphere, but I'm not making the dictionary rules, obviously. And why are you looking at me like that?
You should make the dictionary rules.
I think so?
You should start a new blog.
Yeah.
LanesDictionary.com.
Oh, yeah. There wouldn't be that
when,
many
when are we going to get? We going to get webinar in there next year? That'll be great.
It might be in there. That. An infographic also made it.
Mm-hmm. Pivot. Oh, wait. That's already a word. All right, on to the calendar. The PlayStation Network's Welcome Back content is now available, although PC Magazine is reporting that the process just is kind of buggy and some of the games aren't downloading properly, and they're still really apologetic.
They need a Welcome Back program for the Welcome Back program.
Yes, Welcome Back to our... We're sorry. This isn't working all
the
that well.
The apology packaging.
Yeah, so it's rolling out slowly. This is a pretty vague calendar item. In fact, maybe the vaguest one we've had so far. Google will offer phone support for advertisers and publishers next quarter sometime.
Way to commit, Google.
Not soon, but sort of soon.
Quarter.
Not that long from now. And a reminder that WWDC starts on Monday, June 6th. It's in San Francisco. We will be covering it live. And we'll also, of course, be covering everything that has been discussed on that episode of TNT and throughout the week, as well as covering E3, which, if you don't know what that is, it's the Electronic Entertainment Expo. It starts on June 7th. That's the day after WWDC down in L.A. Leo and Brian Brushwood will be at E3 down in L.A. covering the floor and the announcements. We will also be covering as much as we can from here, too. So it's a pretty exciting week for the second week of June.
But you know exactly what we'll be covering all week. It'll be Apple and gaming.
Yeah.
Probably not together, though.
No. But they'll be competing for, you know, who can make the biggest announcement type of thing. Apple gets to go first. So they've kind of got Monday in the bag unless
a lot of
E3 announcements start trickling out.
Microsoft starts on Monday, too. That diamond thing is supposed to be the same day as the first.
Yeah, they've started doing that at E3 where they'll have a big announcement before the show actually starts. All right.
They're not doing the big French weirdo thing this year like they did last year, though. Not French weirdo. I apologize to everyone who likes that. What's it called?
I have no idea.
The Vegas dancers thing. Cirque du Soleil. They're not doing that this year. They did it last year.
Oh, right. I remember that. Where everyone had to wear the white lab coats for Kinect, and it was a big to-do.
I must have missed this.
We had Becky Worley there. Yeah, it was strange. She was she looked like a Heaven's Gate member. It was just weird. Yeah, Scott, thank you for the reminder. It was nice to go back in time a year. All right, let's move on to the emails. First one from Sapandi says, sorry, but you guys have been taking this extreme EFF view of all things digitally related crime, even hacking. Please don't sensationalize saying that this law will have people in the same house arrested for streaming Netflix. This is what we talked about yesterday. Netflix gives you express permission to stream up to 4 devices in your household. They can't prosecute you until you share beyond your contract. And what's this about online crime not deserving the same punishment as real life crime? For example, you go to an all-you-can-eat buffet and you will go to jail if you skip out on your bill. Dine and dash. It's not cool. As for sharing, I actually just said that. Sapandi didn't actually say that. As for sharing, you can't pay for one buffet and then feed the person at the next table. You can't do that. And it's your responsibility to stop sharing like that. What if the restaurant finds that you're leeching after you've finished eating? Should they just let you go and not offer service anymore? Criminal laws are there, not just to prosecute, but to deter. And if there's no punishment, then there's no deterrence. Okay.
It might have sounded like we were sensationalizing. The reason why it sounded that way is because this law was written so broadly that even in the household thing, forget about Netflix's terms of service. I can have terms of service that are illegal. I mean, that's easy situation here. Because they allow you to have 4 people in the same house doesn't mean you're not sharing a login, which would mean technically you are breaking that law. The problem was this law is so broad that it could make something that simple, something that Netflix allows already, illegal.
I think Sopani might have gotten riled up because Tom had said, as an example, so in my own household, my wife can't log in to my Netflix account and watch a movie. And Sopani's saying, listen, you can give permission to up to four devices in your household, but that's still just for one account. I mean, they don't do like joint accounts for Netflix. So as you're saying, the law is broad enough so that if Tom's wife is watching a movie and he's not watching it with her, it's still wrong.
Yeah, it's the law itself is a little ridiculous. It's not that it's going to be, well, hopefully it won't be actually executed that way.
Right.
We got an email from Jason. Again, not that Jason, though.
A different Jason.
How do you know?
It's the only other Jason in the world.
Any Jasons you see in the dock, probably.
It's always you. Okay, we got an email from this Jason over here, or maybe not him. Tom, Sarah, I, as in Jason. So maybe he wrote to you.
Jason to Jason.
Regarding comments on yesterday's show about hacking Sony, etc. as hacktivism and drawing parallels with the Boston Tea Party. The distinction the commenter missed is the civil disobedience in general and the Boston Tea Party in particular are protests against the government and not private corporations. Governments create law and have a monopoly on the use of force. Sometimes it becomes necessary when no other recourse is possible because the law itself restricts it to violate those laws in protest. Private companies do not create laws or have the ability to throw you in jail or worse. Your association with them is voluntary. Plus, there are numerous legal ways to protest their behavior. Civil disobedience against non-civic entities is a contradiction in terms. Attacks against Sony or Amazon are not protest or activism or even whistleblowing. They are just hooliganism. There may be maybe borderline cases where a company is closely linked to the government, like Northrop Grumman. Such actions might have some legitimacy, but hacking Sony and publishing using users' accounts doesn't come close to being the same thing. Thanks for the show. That was Jason. That was a really well thought out email. I kind of agree with it.
Yeah,
I completely agree with it.
I think
he's dead on.
Well, Jason, yeah, you did well, man.
That was awesome. Thank you.
We agree with your email.
We had a great set of emails, by the way.
Yeah, so I'll keep kidding that up. Aside, that was a good one. Thanks for sending
it
in.
Next up, we got one for Tom or Scott, Sarah, Jason, and I. As I used to work as a web developer, says Jeremy, for a local newspaper. TulsaWorld.com is the address.
Plug.
They rolled out a metered subscription model in the last couple of months. And I can tell you exactly why they were charged less for a digital plus paper subscription than a digital one alone. The ABA allows them to count digital and physical subscriptions twice, which is the basis for advertising rates that are set in the paper, which is why there is a vast majority of their income. That's where the vast majority of their income comes from. So by making something like a Sunday only subscription that includes a digital component cheaper than they in effect make most of the digital subscribers count twice. Keep up the dynamite work, he says.
Okay, so that makes sense, actually. That sheds a little bit more light on why it's like, if you're a print subscriber, you can get the iPad version of the newspaper, for example, but you can't just get the iPad version of the newspaper because we want our advertisers to think...
You're two people.
Yeah.
You can be ad twice.
Right.
That's great. Well, that's good to know that that's how we get deals, by...
Yeah. That's obviously a very broken system, if that's really the reason that papers need to be printed is because they're trying to fool advertisers into thinking they have more readers than they actually have. I mean, it's a universal issue, really. I mean, online folks have the same issues where it's, you know, you're counting hits versus unique users versus IP addresses and all of that.
The only number that counts is the one that you show that the people will pay you.
Right.
That's the only one that matters, right? And this one, there's two subscriptions. Yeah. They seem to be the same. No, they're the same.
In any case, Jeremy, thanks for shedding a little bit of light on why that clunky newspaper we need to kill trees system is still in place. It's because they want money from advertisers. I want to remind everybody, go to bricks.twit.tv. If you want to be part of our new studio, you can buy a brick, put your name on it, put your company logo on it.
Get one like this.
You could put Leo Laporte Chief Twit on it.
So we seem to already have one of those. Yeah. If you want a larger brick, an 8x8, you can even... put a logo on there.
Yeah, they're really nice. So those are the bricks that are actually going to go up in the front area of our new studio. So anybody who walks in, sees your name in lights and makes us feel good, makes you feel
you
good
can
to
come
be a
by,
part of it.
Visit your brick.
Yeah, you can also
bring flowers.
You can also get your own copy, a replica of the brick that
it
you
would actually
have.
Be a larger brick. I don't think it's just a brick.
Yeah, they're designed to go on a wall, so they're not too deep. But you'd actually get
that's
this
the brick.
Version. That, oh gosh,
don't drop that on your laptop.
Let's break this.
There you go.
This is the replica brick you
yeah,
will get.
Yeah, that you can actually get to keep it home.
Don't drop it on your laptop, Iaz.
Just drop it on my
head. Don't do it.
Don't do
That's
it.
That's actually heavier than a normal brick.
It really
brick.
Is pretty heavy.
It's really heavy. It's like more, normal bricks are
so
a little bit more porous.
It's worth the
dense
donation.
Bricks.
Plus, it gets us in our studio a little faster, which we'd love to do.
Yeah, we really appreciate all the support we've gotten so far. Again, that URL, if you want to help us out, is bricks.twit.tv. Be part of the magic. It's like Disneyland, sort of. Scott Johnson, thanks so much for joining us today. Tell folks where they can get a hold of you online.
Well, they
otherwise,
sure can.
What's your street address?
Well, the street address is, no, I won't give him that. Looking very much forward. I'm going to actually see Tom in a couple of weeks here at Nerdtacular. Very excited about that. People want to learn more about that. That's at frogpants.com. And everything else I have going on, frogpants.com will point you in the right direction. And you guys, thanks for having me on. I love hanging out with you guys. It was great.
Absolutely. Come back soon. 260 TNT show is the voicemail. If you want to give us a call, tnt@twit.tv is the email address. We got a lot of really awesome emails today. So thanks, everybody. Thanks, everyone, for watching, listening, downloading
Maybe
later, subscribing, and all of the above. See you on Monday. Happy Liquid Friday. Woo! Woo-woo! It's a heavy brick.
It's a heavy brick.